Back in the time of the Buddha, it was said that someone who had tasted or caught a glimpse of what the Buddha's teachings were about had experienced confirmed confidence, that their confidence in the Dharma was something was based on their own direct experience, their knowing of something. And those people who had this kind of confirmed confidence has said that they could say, or would describe what they understood was in the Pali phrase that has come down through the ages as part of the liturgy of Theravada Buddhism. It's chanted a lot. I won't chant it exactly, but it goes something like this. Svakato, svakato, bhagavato, dhammo, sanditiko, akaliko, ehipasiko, upanyayiko, pacham, veditaba, vinyuhi. I kind of like saying it a little bit, my poor pronunciation, but just that it connects us to a long line of people who have found this to be true for themselves, that they've confirmed for themselves. It doesn't mean that we realize the fullness of what the Buddha experienced, but it's possible to have a taste of it, to know it enough for oneself that there's a confidence. And so this, what they, to translate it, this can be translated different ways. And but one way to translate it is that for the wise, the Dharma of the Buddha is well taught, well spoken. It is visible here and now, immediate, inviting us to come and see, onward leading, to be experienced for oneself, to be known for one's, for, by oneself. So wise people know this. This is something to be experienced by oneself. It's here and now, immediate, onward leading. And I love the expression ehipasiko. It's usually translated something like come and see, or inviting us to come and see. So these have wonderful ideas of it's visible here and now. Something we can see for ourselves. It's very closely related, this word, sanditiko, with in this very life, to be seen here in this very life. And that something about the Dharma, is immediate. The term could also be translated as not of time, not something that takes time. So what is it about the Dharma that doesn't take time? It's immediate. It's not something that requires, you know, if I huff and puff and retreat for enough retreats, then someday I'll see something. What is it that's right here? Now, and this wonderful expression, inviting inspection, inviting us to look more deeply. What is this Dhamma? And I don't associate it only with what the Buddha is teaching, the words he teaches, though that's kind of what it's one of the subjects of the phrase. But there's something about the Dharma as the natural laws of this life that we live. And as we're present for things, there's something in the attention we give to whatever's happening, that there's an invitation. Take a stronger look, take a deeper look, come here and look. There's a little bit of a notion of motion, movement. The word ehi, epasiko, means to approach. So we go and approach to see more clearly. In Chinese Buddhism, they have this idea that awakening beckons us within everything. Isn't that a nice idea? Like, awakening invites us, beckons us, calls us, here, come here. Here's where awakening is, but in everything. That's a pretty positive view of everything. So approach it. And this onward leading, the word also means something like approaching close to, coming almost to a conclusion, coming to the end. So it's something that brings us along in the Dharma on the path, helps us to approach what the Buddha was really saying, and to be personally realized, experienced, known for oneself. And two of these ideas have motion in them. Come here and see, and onward leading. The first one, I think, is the motion that we offer, that we step up to the situation. We come on retreat, we come sit on the cushion, we show up. There's a showing up that's needed. And then there's the onward leading, and I think of like the conveyor belt. The Dharma is a conveyor belt. Put yourself on it, it'll carry you along. I can't help but to do that. In the suttas, sometimes the Buddha is asked the question, how is it that this is onward? How is it visible here now? And how can we experience it for ourselves? How is it this works? Where do we see it? It's visible here now. Where do we see it? It's a good question, right? And the answer that's usually given is we see it by knowing something about the specific kinds of attachments, clingings that we have. And then we see they're no longer there. So this is not some great mystical experience. It's not some great cosmic experience of consciousness or something. But it's kind of mundane. I was angry, and the anger is gone. Wow, is that possible? I was greedy, now it's gone. I was jealous, I was resentful, and now it's gone. I was deluded, and now it's gone. And of course, I think we can maybe have this as a regular part of our life in some way, because we're distracted from our greed and delusion and anger or something sometimes, so it's not there. But to have some kind of deeper qualitative sense, wow, it's not here right now. It can be particularly nice on retreats where if you're struggling with the hindrances for a few days, few weeks, and then somehow, maybe by accident, they're not there. And it's so refreshing. It's so nice. Such a relief. Wow. So is this possible? And there are people who have a mindset that they've had for decades, which they think is just inherent. They don't even know it's there because it's such a common part. It's like they say fish don't see the water they swim in. Sometimes people don't see the greed, the anger, the delusion they're swimming in. But to find it stopped, even for a few moments, this is possible. Wow. I didn't even know that I was caught so much. Many years ago, there was a woman who did a retreat. And she came back to a retreat a year later and said, you know, at that last retreat, my cynicism disappeared. And in this last year, it hasn't returned. And she was like kind of in awe that she had been a cynic for so much of her life. And, wow. Vanished. Gone. So one way that it's visible here and now is we see the letting go, the release, the absence. And so rather than looking for some kind of great insight into reality or whatever, it's important to appreciate the release of these kinds of clingings and holdings we have, attachments we have. And to release it, there's an invitation in reality to look at where we're holding, to look at where the clinging is. So that's one way I understand this, that, you know, inviting us to inspect is that because to cling to anything, to hold on to anything tight, takes work, takes energy, it takes effort. And the movement of chronic effort, the desire in the effort is to stop doing it. If you're carrying heavy suitcase in both arms for a few years, I bet you'll have the arms will be more than inviting you to put the suitcases down, but will be screaming, please put them down. It just kind of just, what a real, you know, just the muscles and everything, please give me a break. So come and look here, look more closely to take a good and feel what's happening here. There's a desire. And then as we release the holding, the clinging, all the effort that goes into clinging, all that energy is now freed up for something else. And I like to think of it as something that emerges, the emergent in us. And this is why, you know, this wonderful paradox sometimes in practice where we learn or we practice not trying to attain anything or get anything, and just kind of learn to be really present for what's here in and of itself, what's directly visible here and now, what's immediate, not of time, just this experience now. Is counterintuitive for many people who feel they have to fix things and change things and improve things, and you have something to show for yourself. Come back from retreat, you know, you have to be able to say something to your friends. You know, what happened? Well, you know, I sat and walked, and then they tell you that they went on vacation. It's like, you know, gee. I just sat and walked. But it's not just sitting and walking. This showing up and being present for something without being driven by greed, desires, aversions, wanting it to be different, holding on tight, is a radical thing to do. It begins to pull the rug from underneath, kind of the citadel that we've built up with of self, of world. It's built up on attachment. It's built on a foundation of clinging. And when the clinging is not there, because we're dedicated to not doing anything, it's onward leading. The citadel begins to fade away, or we find ourselves on that conveyor belt of the Dharma that moves us into this place where there's something that begins to emerge. That Dharma joy emerges. Dharma peace emerges. Dharma confidence emerges. Dharma wisdom emerges. All this stuff begins to show there's room for it now. And there's not room for it if we're preoccupied with our attachments, our fears, or whatever it might be. So one of the ways that we're preoccupied, at least a few of us, is clinging to the aggregates. And this the Pali word, upadana skanda, kanda, can be understood in many ways. The word kanda is evocative and has many meanings. Today's meaning that I'd like to emphasize is that the word kanda means a pile. Upadana means clinging. Piles of clinging. A lifetime of clingings has made a huge pile, many piles. And those piles, you know, don't just go away. But you can't see them. Look under your mattress. They're not sitting there waiting for you. But they're in your heart. They're in your psyche. They have their impact on you. So we you know, there's kind of an accumulation of these piles of our clinging. And for sake of somehow getting some clarity about these clingings, the Buddha talked about these five areas, five domains where, or, you know, five major piles of clingings that are accumulated. And so visible here and now, clinging to appearances. We can see them, we can feel them, we can sense the sensations. This we see when some side object comes into view, we can see it and know we're seeing it, to hear something, hear it. Feel it in our body. And I particularly like the sensing in the body because that's where the muscles tighten up. And so you can have a physical proof sometimes that you're clinging, that you're attached, that you're holding on. And so to say this, you know, here and now you can feel it. And that's inviting inspection. So these feelings that we have, the feeling tones, what are they? What's the pleasure? What's the pain? What is it that we're invited to feel more deeply into the pleasure and the pleasure and the pain, comfort and discomfort, to feel more deeply, what is this? What is this? And one of the reasons it's so profound to ask the question, what are these feelings of pleasant and pain, pleasure and pain that we have? Is because we start seeing that there's two different types, as I talked about earlier. But I like this, you know, the of the flesh, not of the flesh, worldly, not worldly, spirit, worldly, but spiritual and spiritual, all these different attempts to try to describe it. I think of it as the kind of pleasure and pain that comes because our nerves have been stimulated by something. And that which emerges when nothing is stimulated, the ordinary senses are not being, getting sense contact with something. And the pleasures that emerge are waiting for us. So inviting inspection. What is this that's possible? What is here? What is this possibilities of pleasure and pain that we have? There's Dharma pleasure. And then inviting inspection, recognition, a third aggregate. We have a label, we have an idea. And I think that, to recognize means to recognize again. We carry an idea with us and we apply it to different situations. And but because of that, it's kind of a projection often. And to take a deeper look, inspect it. What are my projections? What are my ideas that I have here? Are they real? Are they true? Are they partially true? Are they functionally true? Are they useful? Or are they not useful? Have I tested it? Have I looked more closely to see if it's really true? So when we start kind of experimenting or playing with these, the recognitions, the ideas, the concepts by which we understand things, the Dharma asks us to come and look more closely. What's really here? And then the mental formations. They're the ones that one way or the other are onward leading. Because mental formations are where we cling. Those are the, clinging is a mental formation, is a mental construct. And it's even possible to cling to clinging. And when we cling a lot, we get locked up, sometimes even frozen, sometimes numb. But when it's onward leading, when we go deeply into this world and finding our way through on the other side of freeing ourselves up from the generative thinking, the obsessive thinking, the attachments, the pulling away, the aversion, the hostility, the avariciousness that we might have. And so as we begin to loosen up that whole complex, the freeing of that allows this Dharma joy to emerge, allows for the emergence of all kinds of things. It's, it helps us to move closer and closer to freedom, closer to this qualitative experience of having the absence of greed, hate, and delusion, the absence of resentment and fear and all kinds of things. And to be experienced by the wise, the knowing, we're here to know, to be known by the wise. And so this wonderful fifth aggregate, in some ways, is like provides the doorway for all this freedom. And it's through perception, the perceiving, the knowing, the act of being conscious of individual experience, that really kind of begins opening the space, opening the room to discover freedom, to make room for what's going to emerge as we practice. So we find the Dharma through our clingings by bringing attention to it and feeling it, knowing it, approaching it. Come here and look more deeply. Look at these hindrances, these aggregates, these clingings. Don't be afraid of your clinging, so you don't ever look at them. Take a good, honest look. This is how it is. One of the things I love about Dharma practice is how it makes people honest. Sooner or later, you just have to kind of fess up. You know, tell them, yep. turns out, I was trying not to admit this to myself, but it turns out that I am clinging, holding on, attached to some conceit or other. And then there's the absence of clinging. There's appearances that appear, sensations and sight objects and things we hear and smell and taste and think and things that appear in the mind. And it's remarkable to be able to have sense objects, all the senses operating fully, in a sense, without a sense experience automatically triggering desire or aversion, automatically triggering, what does this mean for me? Is this safe for me? Is this good for me? Is this something I want or something I don't want? And part of that is to not have that always operating and begin to feel and appreciate and value looking at things, anything, without having an agenda, without needing to do anything about what we're looking at. Oh, look at that. And then maybe there's a pause, and maybe after a while you realize, well, I should take care of it. So you do, but it's not, you know, there's to have this sense of space of non-clinging in relationship to what we see and hear and all our senses. Some people report that makes the sensory world vivid, really vivid. Kind of everything shimmers or seems special. In the world of attachment and wanting things to be a certain way, it's a piece of trash left on the street, on the sidewalk. It's like these people, all these people who are thoughtless and making trash, and we should really have better laws or trash policemen, police officers, and, you know, just kind of all this papancha comes up. But maybe, you know, looking at the piece of trash on the sidewalk and, wow, it's shiny, that little candy wrapper. Wow, look at that. I've been in, when I went some years ago to the Grand Canyon, and there were places in the Grand Canyon that, from one point of view, it was just a mess. I mean, the amount of boulders that come coming down off the cliffs and piling up in this pile, you know, unorganized, chaotic way all over the bottom of the valley. And I mean, someone, Park Service, would come and clean it up. You know, it's been there long enough, a few 100,000 years, and someone should have cleaned it up by now. I mean, it's just a mess. But no one thinks that way when they go in the Grand Canyon. It's like, wow. But the candy wrapper, someone should clean it up. Is that automatic? Do we have to live in a world where we interpret it that way? Is there trash in you? Someone should clean you up. The park service, you call him in. Is there any trash at all? Or is trash itself a higher ordered abstract recognition that maybe is functional? It means something is in a place where we'd rather not be. So maybe you have certain things that you'd rather not to be. They're functionally not helpful. But why call it trash? What does that do to your psyche to be critical of what appears there? What about just, wow, I had a moment of anger. There was a lot of energy. Look at that energy. Wow, that was unpleasant. Wow. I could feel the stories starting to build up around it. Wow. And I'm aware of it. Wow. Is that ridiculous to approach life that way? Or unrealistic? I don't know. Maybe it's unrealistic. Maybe it's something, but the alternative is worse. Just go along and be angry. And tell everyone to get out of the way. But to stop and look and wow. Come and look. What is it that's immediate? Not of time. Are we waiting for something to happen? I was really inspired when many years ago there was a Vipassana teacher named Christopher Titmus. And I think someone said something in the meditation hall at the retreat about waiting for something, like waiting for them to get, waiting to get concentrated or waiting to get settled in or something. And he said very compassionately, he said, if you're waiting, you've already missed the boat. Because it's immediate, right here. To wait is to cling to something, to hold on, to expect something, to live in abstraction. What's right here and now? And one of those things that here now is freedom, is letting go, is non-clinging. And that's one of the things that we can run the aggregate scales with. When there's an experience of not clinging to something, what appears then? What are the sensations that come along with that? Is there a sense of loosening up, a settling, a relaxing? Is there a wonderful coolness, a wonderful feeling of ease that might come? What are the sensations that appear when clinging is released? What are the feelings that come? Is it pleasant or unpleasant or neutral? And if it's pleasant, what kind of pleasure is it? Does it feel like it's been there because you've been stimulated by some pleasant sense experience? Or is it emergent? What is that emergent, the Dharma that emerges to feel that, to make room for that? What is this Dharma pleasure that comes with not clinging? And what are the recognitions that come? What could be simple? Just this is non-clinging. This is the pleasure of non-clinging. These are the sensations of non-clinging. Or we can get tripped up and say, I'm hot stuff. Look at this. I hope everyone's noticing. You know, I'm the non-clinger. And then what's the mental formations that comes along with it? And certainly there could be mental formations and stories and ideas that take us away from it. But are there mental formations that put us into it, that are supportive of it, that are onward leading for it, that kind of, you know, are the mental formations of inspiration, mental inspirations of dedication, commitment even. Oh, this is good. This is the way forward. This is what I would like to orient myself to. This kind of freedom. This is a freedom that doesn't require beliefs, doesn't require fancy spiritual experiences. In some ways, it's very simple. Maybe it's okay to be simple. Maybe I don't have to be anybody special. What a relief. So there might be some useful mental formations, some useful realizations, understandings that come when we start experiencing non-clinging. And then what is your perception like? What is your knowing like? What is mindfulness like? How is it? What is it like to be conscious when there's not any clinging? So here we take these areas, these five areas, and we can kind of use it to investigate, or to, if you don't like the word investigate, maybe, but to fill in the picture, to get the fuller sense of what's happening, all the pieces of it. It's like if you were looking at a rose plant that was in full flower, and for some reason you decided the only thing worth looking at is the thorns, you don't really see the whole thing. But you know, there's the flowers, there's a stem, there's the leaves, there's so much there. And to open up to the fullness of it makes life richer. So the fullness of non-clinging. And also there's a fullness of clinging itself. So to really understand all the different aspects of clinging. When we cling to anything, I suspect that all five aggregates are there. We can look at it from the lens of all five. Any kind of clinging we have will have some quality of, we're clinging to something that has appeared, or there's sensations involved with it, there's tensions involved with it. There's probably some pleasant and unpleasant, maybe neutral, but there's some probably unpleasantness with clinging. There's something we're recognizing, maybe falsely, maybe accurately. There's probably some mental formations involved, deep beliefs. And there's some kind of perception going on, some kind of knowing, but maybe knowing that's not being used in a healthy way. You're using your knowing to reinforce that which pulls you down. Keep looking at the same thing over and over again. That is kind of maybe not healthy to keep focusing on. Certain thoughts, keep looking at certain thoughts, certain ideas. I'm a lousy meditator. I'm a lousy meditator. I'm a lousy meditator. I mean, by now you're kind of tired of me saying it, right? Give me a break. But do you ever get tired of yourself kind of having those kinds of thoughts? It's one of the amazing kind of wonders of the universe, is that people can have that same kind of thought 10,000 times, still have it, and just as fresh each time. And it might be almost subliminal sometimes. I'm a lousy meditator. I'm a lousy meditator. So then our capacity to know, to perceive, to be conscious, keeps orienting itself to those thoughts in some way. So we can kind of see what's the orientation, what's happening here when we cling. And so then we begin maybe that very investigation. Come and look. The Dharma is something to investigate. Come and look. It's here and now. It's not somewhere else. It's what's happening now that we find our freedom. What kind of freedom can I find that's immediate? And one of the answers to that, I think for people who practice mindfulness, we eventually learn that just a moment of mindfulness, right there in that mindfulness, there is a kind of freedom. That if the mindfulness is kind of simple enough, clear enough, the mindfulness itself contains no agenda, contains no clinging. The mindfulness itself does not need things to be different. Something in you wants things to be different. But wow, this mindfulness, it's immediate, just this here. And not needing anything to be different does not mean that things don't become different. Not needing things to be different means that all the attempts to make things different begins to slow down and stop. And that creates space for something to emerge. The emergent Dharma. So one of the purposes of this talk, I hope, is for you to encourage you to inspect, to look more deeply at your experience of non-clinging, non-attachment, non-craving, non-obsession. And you all have them. Maybe it's not 100% to have, no clinging whatsoever. But I'm sure that there's something that you've clung to already today, that you've been obsessed with or caught in, that probably you're not caught in right now. Something that you felt caught up in a little bit, maybe, when you started a meditation session. Some thought train or you were involved in, and it was hard to put it down. But lo and behold, by the end of the sitting, you'd put it down. No longer kind of driving the show. When you start noticing the absence of clinging, run the scales with it. Try to kind of fill out the picture, sense more fully what it's like. It'll put you in the present moment, and it'll begin to recondition you, offer you, I hope, some kind of healthy thing to do with your wonderful capacity to know. A positive conditioning, rather than being conditioned by, I'm a lousy meditator. It's being conditioned by, wow, this is good. But it's not good enough. One of the not good enough, the kind of 10,000 kinds of thoughts that I had that for years was, it didn't took me a long time to see it, but it was operating, was this very subtle, quiet idea, background idea in meditation that if it's happening to me, it's not the real thing. It's not, you know, it can't be, you know. And so I, you know, just it was always kind of tripping me up a little bit. And it, but I didn't know it was there until some point I got somehow quiet enough or something that I said, oh, look at that. Oh, is that really true? And then eventually I could drop it. But look at the non-clinging. Let non-clinging be support for you. See if non-clinging, don't cling to non-clinging. Don't cling to investigating it. Don't cling to trying to have some great insight about non-clinging. Just this kind of like, notice it. Do the scales, notice it more fully. Fill in the picture. And maybe after these days of the talks on the aggregates, maybe you're practicing with them. Maybe it's a time to also begin appreciating more deeply non-clinging. The Dhamma of the Buddha is well spoken. It is visible here and now, timeless, immediate, inviting inspection, onward leading, to be known, to be experienced personally by the wise. And may each of you become the wise person that you're capable of becoming. Thank you all.